Usually when we talk about the concept of a final judgment, whether that's looking at ancient mythology or pop culture or just like how we naturally think about fairness, there's always this expectation of a cosmic audit.
Right, like a giant spreadsheet of everything you've ever done.
Yeah, exactly. It's a highly transactional view of the universe. You reach the end of the line and someone pulls out this massive dusty ledger.
And you just hope the math works out.
Pretty much. Good deeds in the left column, bad deeds in the right. And, if it works out in your favor, if your good slightly outweighs your bad, you're golden.
It's clean, it's predictable.
Right. But in the famous text we're diving into today, which is Jesus's Olivet Discourse in Matthew chapter 25, that whole ledger concept is just thrown completely out the window.
Oh, absolutely out the window.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at a theological breakdown of this exact moment. Jesus is describing the end times and his return in glory, and he presents a scenario where all of humanity is gathered right before him.
And he begins to separate people.
Yeah, using this really vivid agrarian image of a shepherd separating a mixed flock of sheep and goats.
Which, I mean, that would have been a very familiar everyday image for his original first century audience.
Because they actually did that, right?
Yeah, flocks were often mixed during the day. They'd graze together, but they had to be separated at night. So he takes that mundane reality and just uses it to convey this massive, eternal dividing line.
It's a striking image, and our mission for this deep dive is to examine this specific text for you through a very particular lens, which is the evangelical Christian perspective.
Right.
We want to define exactly who these sheep and these goats really are according to the source material we've gathered. And in doing so, we're going to uncover a highly surprising nuance about how they are actually judged.
Because what makes this source material so compelling is that it frames this event not as a simple morality test, but as a really profound revelation of identity.
Okay, identity.
Yeah. If you approach this text thinking it's just about, handing out gold stars for charity work, the actual theology behind it is going to catch you entirely off guard.
Well, to really figure out who the sheep and the goats are, we first have to understand the fundamental rule of how they're being separated in the first place.
Exactly.
There's a specific theological lens our source material provides that serves as the foundation for the entire scene, right?
Right, yeah. You cannot understand the mechanics of this passage without understanding the core framework of evangelical theology, which the source identifies as the doctrine of justification by grace through faith.
Okay, I want to pause right there because that is a very dense theological phrase.
It is a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, so break down the actual mechanics of that for us. What does justification by grace through faith actually mean when we're talking about people being separated at the end of the world?
So the source points directly to a foundational text to explain this view, which is Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. And it explicitly states that salvation is a gift from God received through faith. It is not something you can earn. And it is explicitly not the result of works, so that no one can boast.
No bragging rights.
None. That is the operating system running in the background of this entire text. Salvation is viewed as a free gift of grace, completely unearned by any sort of human effort.
And I feel like this is where it clashes so hard with human nature, because like I said earlier, people usually think of final judgment like a cosmic video game where you farm karma points.
Right. Ding, plus 10 points.
Exactly. You help an old lady cross the street, plus 50 points. You cut someone off in traffic, minus 20 points.
And you just hope your score is positive at the end.
Yeah. But you're saying, according to this perspective, the separation between the sheep and the goats isn't a scale at all.
It is definitely not a scale. Think about it. If the underlying rule is that salvation cannot be earned by good works, then the king in Matthew 25 cannot possibly be weighing their deeds to determine if they get into the kingdom.
Right, because that would contradict the whole grace thing.
Exactly. Instead, the separation is a public revelation of who genuinely belongs to Christ and who does not. It's an exposure of their true internal nature.
So it's not that the sheep did enough good things to become sheep.
No, not at all.
They were already sheep. And the judgment is simply the shepherd recognizing his own flock.
That's a great way to put it. The separation merely makes public what was already true internally for these people.
Okay, but I have a question here. If there's no cosmic scale and, good deeds don't buy salvation, why does the king spend so much time listing out the sheep's good deeds?
Yeah, that is the big question.
Because it seems like a massive contradiction to the whole concept of grace we just talked about. The king looks at the sheep and explicitly says, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me.
Naked and you clothed me.
Right. Sick and in prison and you visited me. I mean, if works don't save you, why are the sheep being praised for all these very specific actions?
Well, the source document clarifies this paradox beautifully, actually, by defining the role of works for the sheep. It uses a very specific phrase. It says their works are evidence, not currency.
Evidence, not currency. Oh, that is a really fascinating distinction.
It really is. I mean, think about currency. Currency is something you use to buy a product.
Right.
You don't use your good deeds to buy salvation. That's the transactional view. Evidence, on the other hand, is proof that an event has already happened.
Okay, I see where this is going.
So the sheep's actions, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, those are described as the natural overflow of a transformed heart. The good works are the effect of their salvation, not the cause of it.
I look at it kind of like breathing.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, you don't consciously wake up and think, I need to inhale and exhale 5,000 times today so that I can earn the status of being a living human.
Right, you'd pass out if you had to think about it that much.
Exactly. Breathing is just a natural byproduct of being alive. Because you are alive, your lungs take in oxygen. So according to this framework, because these people were saved, they loved others.
They loved others instinctively.
Yeah. They weren't volunteering at a soup kitchen just to pad their heavenly resumes.
The breathing analogy holds up perfectly, especially when you look at how the sheep actually respond in the text. The source refers to their state as unconscious righteousness.
Unconscious righteousness.
Yeah. When the king praises the sheep for all these wonderful things they did for him, they are completely bewildered.
They literally ask, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty?
Right.
They have absolutely no memory of doing these things for him.
And this reaction reveals a really profound, deep humility. I mean, think back to that karma system we discussed earlier.
The video game points.
Yeah. If they were operating on a point-based system, they would have had their receipts
right. Oh, totally. They'd be like, yes, Lord, remember that Tuesday in October?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I gave 20 bucks to that charity. I need that counted on my ledger.
Right.
But they have no ledger. They didn't serve the vulnerable to earn religious points or to secure a reward. They acted out of organic, Christ-like love. It was simply their new nature.
It's almost as if keeping track of your own good deeds actually proves you've entirely missed the point of grace.
That's exactly what the scholars are arguing.
But okay, there is one detail about the sheep in this passage that I want to push back on a little bit.
Sure.
Before he even mentions their works, the king says to them, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world.
Yes.
Meaning, before they were even born. So doesn't that make this entire judgment scene just like a piece of cosmic theater? I mean, why even have a judgment if the guest list was finalized at the dawn of time?
It can definitely look like a rigged game from the outside. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
But the scholars we're looking at argue that this detail isn't about fatalism.
Okay.
It's actually the ultimate proof of the grace we just talked about.
Yeah.
It's meant to assure the reader that their salvation depends entirely on God's character, not their own fragile performance.
So it takes the pressure off the human end of the equation.
Exactly. The judgment scene isn't the moment the decisions is being actively debated and decided. It's the moment the reality of God's prior grace is publicly vindicated.
Got it.
Their ultimate destiny, eternal life, was prepared for them by God's sovereign choice long before they could ever do a single good deed.
Well, by understanding that the sheep's defining trait is this unconscious act of love born from a transformed heart, it perfectly frames the tragic reality of the second group.
The goats.
Right. We have to look at the goats. And this is sobering because the goats are defined not necessarily by active malice or like cartoonish evil, but by what they failed to do.
Yeah. In this theological framework, the goats represent the unrighteous, unregenerate people who lack a true saving relationship with Christ.
Hold on, unregenerate, that's a heavy theological word right there. What are these scholars actually describing when they use that term?
So it's the source material's way of describing someone whose core spiritual nature hasn't been transformed. Regenerate basically means spiritually reborn or made new. So unregenerate means their fundamental nature hasn't changed. They're still operating entirely on their own terms, completely separated from the life of God.
Which explains a really striking parallel in the text. Just like the sheep, the goats are also completely surprised by the king's judgment.
Yes, they are genuinely shocked.
The king says, I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. And the goats say, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty and did not help you? They are absolutely stunned to be in the goat category.
It pushes back heavily on the idea of them being obvious mustache-twirling villains.
Right. They probably thought of themselves as, you know, good enough people. They didn't rob anyone. They didn't murder anyone.
They just minded their own business.
Exactly. It's like we've all been in a situation where you see the jam in the office printer, you look left, you look right, and you just keep walking.
Someone else's problem.
Right. You didn't break the printer, so you sleep fine at night. It's bystander apathy. The goats didn't necessarily cause the suffering in the world. They just ignored it. They walked right past it.
But this text is saying that exact apathy is a symptom of a fundamentally broken heart.
Wow.
The source labels this concept the absence of fruit. So let's stick with the analogies here. Think about a counterfeit currency detector at a bank.
Okay.
The bank teller isn't angry at the fake $100 bill for failing to buy anything. The bill's lack of purchasing power merely proves that it was always a fake piece of paper to begin with.
Oh, I see.
So just as the sheep saving faith is proven by their action, the goat's lack of saving faith is exposed by their inaction.
Their apathy is the smoking gun.
Exactly.
They lived in proximity to suffering and need, but they remained entirely detached.
And this detachment exposes something fundamental about their internal state. Their failure to recognize and serve Christ in others revealed that their hearts were unchanged. They were self-absorbed, alienated from God. They basically failed to show the family resemblance of the king.
It's a terrifying kind of self-deception, really. I mean, they thought they were fine because their ledger of bad deeds wasn't overflowing, but they completely missed that their lack of active love was the proof of a dead faith.
And according to the text, the outcome is stark and completely binary.
Yeah, the king tells the goats to depart into eternal punishment while the righteous go into eternal life. The passage presents absolutely no middle ground here.
No. You either possess a transformed heart that naturally overflows in love, or you possess an unchanged heart that remains apathetic to the things God cares about.
Which brings us to the most famous line in this whole passage. Because up to this point, we know why the groups acted or didn't act. We understand the dynamic of grace and works. But the source document drops a massive exegetical plot twist regarding who they were actually interacting with when they fed the hungry or ignored the sick.
And this is the part that often catches even seasoned theologians off guard. The king says to the sheep, "Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." Now consider how that phrase is usually interpreted in modern culture.
I mean, everywhere you go, that is preached as a universal call to social justice. It's seen as a general humanitarian mandate to serve the poor, the homeless, the marginalized, anywhere in the world.
And it is a beautiful sentiment, and certainly a concept supported by many other parts of the Bible. But prominent evangelical scholars, and the source specifically highlights the work of Adia Carson and R.T. France here, they point out a much more specific exegetical nuance in Matthew's gospel.
Wait. Exegetical. You mean how scholars interpret the original language and grammar of the text, right?
Right, looking at the actual Greek phrasing.
So what exactly did they find when they dug into the original Greek?
They conducted a linguistic analysis of how the author, Matthew, uses the word brothers. And what they found is that throughout Matthew's gospel, Jesus exclusively uses the term brothers to refer to his followers.
His disciples.
Yes, his disciples, the people who do the will of his Father. He does not use it as a blanket, universal term for all of humanity.
Okay, wow. If the least of these brothers of mine specifically means Jesus's followers, that completely shifts the entire scene.
It does.
What does that mean for the judgment of the nations then?
Well, under this stricter interpretation, the judgment isn't based on general philanthropy. It is based specifically on how the world treated Christ's followers.
Mm.
And to grasp the weight of this, you really have to look at the historical context of the early church.
Right, because they weren't exactly comfortable.
Far from it. We're talking about a community facing severe persecution under the Roman Empire. These were missionaries and everyday believers who were rendered homeless, starved, or thrown into dungeons specifically for the sake of preaching the gospel.
So when the king says, "I was in prison and you visited me," he's not just talking about prison reform in a broad modern sense.
No.
He's talking about a Christian who was thrown into a dark Roman cell for claiming Jesus as Lord instead of Caesar.
Exactly.
And the sheep were the ones who took the massive personal risk to go bring that prisonal food.
And remember, associating with a traitor to the state could get you killed.
Right.
That is why it's a test of ultimate allegiance, not just a test of basic human decency. In Christian theology, believers are quite literally considered the body of Christ.
Right, the church is the body.
Yeah. The connection is so intimate that to reject, ignore, or withhold care from a suffering Christian is to do the exact same thing to Jesus himself.
That makes the goat's apathy even more intense.
It really amplifies it.
It wasn't just that they ignored a random beggar on the street. They watched the messengers of Christ be starved and persecuted, and they just turn a blind eye.
Yes.
And by rejecting the messengers, they were rejecting the king who sent them.
And conversely, the sheep, by caring for these persecuted believers, despite the massive risk to their own lives, proved their allegiance to the king.
It's a profound identification.
Jesus is essentially saying, how you treat my people in their darkest, most vulnerable moments is exactly how you were treating me.
Wow.
It turns the passage from a general encouragement to give to charity into a severe, high-stakes revelation of where a person's heart actually resides.
Which perfectly ties back into the idea of works as evidence.
Exactly.
If you truly have saving faith in Jesus, you are going to instinctively care for his people, even if it costs you your reputation or your safety.
Yep.
But if you don't have that faith, you'll walk right by them like that broken office printer. The pieces all fit together perfectly.
The theology of grace, the unconscious nature of the sheep's love, the self-deceiving apathy of the goats, and then the specific identity of the least of these as the persecuted church. It forms a highly cohesive, very demanding theological framework.
Let's pull all of this together for you, the listener, because we have covered a tremendous amount of deep ground today.
We really have.
We started by taking this famous passage out of the realm of a simple moral karma scale. We removed the dusty ledger.
Threw it out the window.
Yeah. And we looked at it through the lens of justification by grace, where salvation is a gift, not a wage.
And we saw that the sheep's compassion is not a currency they use to buy their way into heaven. It is the unconscious, natural fruit of a heart that has already been transformed by grace.
They were simply breathing.
Just grieving.
And then we examined the goats, whose terrifying apathy exposed an unregenerate heart. They were condemned not for grand acts of villainy, but for what they failed to do. Their lack of action was the ultimate proof of a counterfeit faith.
Finally, we unpacked the linguistic and historical context to reveal that the least of these specifically refers to Christ's persecuted followers.
Right.
Which makes the judgment scene a final verdict on how the world responded to the gospel and its messengers.
It really forces you to read the text with entirely fresh eyes. But before we wrap up, we always like to leave you with a provocative thought. Something to mull over or explore on your own that builds on what we've unpacked today.
Yeah, and thinking about the unconscious righteousness of the sheep raises an incredibly difficult question for you to ponder.
Okay, let's hear it.
If true, saving righteousness is entirely unconscious, meaning the sheep were completely, genuinely surprised by their own good deeds, is it even possible to intentionally try to be a sheep?
Oh, wow. That is the ultimate paradox.
Think about it. If you read this text and say to yourself, well, I want to be a sheep, so I'm going to go feed the hungry specifically so I can get the eternal reward.
Right.
Does the very act of serving others simply to secure your own heavenly status instantly reveal that your heart is actually operating like a goat? Can you fake unconscious love?
That is heavy. The harder you try to consciously balance that cosmic ledger to save yourself, the further you get from the effortless grace that actually defines the sheep.
You cannot audit your way into the kingdom.
You really can't. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this exploration gave you a completely new perspective on a text you might have thought you already knew. Keep questioning, keep exploring, and we'll see you next time.